Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture, and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape, both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I am Vish's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do, and now he has me on the record saying that.
Spencer Tweedy is a musician and writer based in Chicago, Illinois. Along with his brother Sammy, Spencer often plays music with his father, Jeff Tweedy, most recently releasing an album together called Love is the King in 2020. The whole family, including Spencer's mom, Susan Miller Tweedy, get together a few times a week at 9 p.m. and they go on Instagram Live to share a variety program they make together called The Tweedy Show. Collaborating with Lawrence Azarad, Spencer recently wrote a beautiful and insightful book called Mirror Sound, The People and Processes Behind Self-Recorded Music, which features inspiring profiles of people like Sharon Van Etten, Letitia Tamco, Bradford Cox, Suzanne Ciani, Mac DeMarco, the late Emmett Rhodes, Namdi, Tuneyards, and more. Mirror Sound was published on October 20th by Prestel, a division of Penguin Random House. And just before the end of that month, I caught up with Spencer to ask him about living in America in 2020 and how he felt while on the cusp of the presidential election's results. What inspired the book Mirror Sound, and how all of this home recording might relate to how so many of us have been forced to work from home during the COVID-19 pandemic. His dad's somewhat similarly instructive new book, How to Write One Song, and other things. We talked about a lot of different things. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 586th episode of Creative Control, featuring the talented and wise beyond his years, Spencer Tweedy, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Of a natural disaster for me. Lord, 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 what misery. Oh, my Lord, what a tragedy. Tears in my eyes, I pray no one can see. Hi, Spencer, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm well. It's nice to chat with you. First of all, where in the world are you?
I'm in Chicago.
How are things in Chicago?
They're pretty good. things have been, as good as it's pretty safe. It's going okay.
okay, that's fair. Now, as we're speaking, people are going to hear this after your country has its big election, and so. Your opinions about things may change by the time people hear this, but I thought I'd get your perspective on what this year has been like for you, both with, the pandemic and the way your country's leadership has been dealing with that, but also, social unrest, people speaking out, people being isolated. I feel like it's very telling that you have a book about people working in isolation. I'm sure people have brought this to your attention already. It's been a weird time. What is your general perspective on how things have gone for you in 2020?
Well, I just have a lot of frustration and a lot of anger at people who, to me, feels like they're deliberately warmongering and drumming up conflict. I'm talking about, I think it's appropriate to just say who they are and what it is. I'm talking about Republican Congress people, Republican senators who are talking about why it's okay for authorities to go and arrest people in unmarked rented minivans off the street and take them to locations where none of their family members or friends know where they've been taken, and telling people that Democrats are planning some sort of coup, and in telling people that, they're encouraging people to basically go and arm themselves and prepare for worst case scenarios. But in reality, I don't think anybody who's protesting or who's trying to make the country better right now is interested in violence or interested in making things even scarier than they already are right now. They're interested in using their voices and in calling for things to get better and for things to be more inclusive and for people to have access to more resources. So I think that they're drumming up conflict in an extremely selfish and scary way. And I just hope that, what they are like perversely hoping for or trying to like concoct doesn't actually end up happening, and people just end up being vocal and trying to preserve our rights and like be loud about their identities. Because I think when people become afraid to go outside and become afraid to go exercise their right to gather and protest, then that's maybe the scariest outcome of all.
Yeah, you're expressing frustration and anger. You've alluded to fear. Are you yourself afraid living in Chicago, living in America right now?
A little bit, but mostly I'm not, because I am a really privileged person, and I have the privilege to stay away from where the majority of conflicts go down, and I'm also privileged to have an identity and an outward presenting appearance that doesn't make me the target of a lot of like the worst hatred out there, even though I am Jewish. But I'm generally pretty insulated in that way. But it's funny, because the problems that Chicago has are pretty widespread, but there are also at the same time exaggerated, and they've also been they've been used as a political tool to make it seem like urban environments are like full of dangerous people, and it's used as like an illustration of or in a justification of racist ideas. But it is true that there is a lot of danger in Chicago. Thankfully, I feel able to go about, you know, normal life, and we just kind of try to be as smart about where we are and when we're outside and what we're doing.
Yeah. Now, as I say, we're speaking, just to be clear, I don't normally date an interview because you never know when it might actually circulate. But as we're speaking, it is October 30th. It is about 12 after 1 p.m. Mountain Time. I'm calling you from Edmonton. So the election is on the 3rd. Mm-hmm. Say it, when you think about the two possibilities there, and I think there may be more than two, there's the opportunity for sweeping change. Mm-hmm. The Senate and the House could be controlled by the Democratic Party. The White House could be controlled by the Democratic Party. Or it might not go that way somehow. I personally think it's going to go that way based on everything I'm reading from up here. You can't tell what I'm reading mm-hmm. up here in Canada, Spencer, but I'm reading some stuff. And it tells me that it's going to go that way, not in a way that I view as negative, which would be mm-hmm. maintaining what's going on now. So
yeah,
that's just, and I think all of this might apply to your book and the figures in your book and the choices they've made a little bit going forward, particularly as this pandemic is going to be with us for some time. But anyway, let's just imagine those two scenarios. One mm-hmm. where let's say, do you agree with me that if the Democrats take over, it'll probably be better, first of all? Let me say that.
Oh, absolutely. There's no okay. question about it okay. to me.
Yeah. I think you were leaning that way. I feel the same. So let's say yeah. it goes that way. What kinds of change? And you know what? Let's just concentrate on that. Let's just assume that's going to happen and not even dwell yeah. on the prospect of a nightmare scenario where it doesn't go that way. What do you anticipate mm-hmm. happening tonally, maybe, just in terms of how people are going to feel the day mm-hmm. after that? And then do you actually think, given all the, you know, filibustering, if you will, I don't mean that in the official sense, but just all the kind mm-hmm. of, you know, ramrodding of stuff that has gone on. Do you think that, are you optimistic that change will, a good positive change will happen in a relatively short period of time if everything goes the way you and I hope it does? What is your perspective on that? Having lived in America for so long and seeing how things can and can't happen, how optimistic are you that real change will come?
Well, to answer your first question quickly, I think that a lot of people will feel super relieved, and a lot of people will feel super scared about the likely near future, but they'll be scared because of totally baseless claims they've been told and that they believe about who Democrats are and what they plan to do and what people who support Democratic politicians are and what they want to happen. I've been doing a little bit of outreach to and get out the vote phone banking calls and things like that. And yeah. I've talked to some people who, when they find out that I'm calling, not in a partisan way, it's just about voter turnout, but when they find out that the organization sponsoring the phone bank is a Democratic organization, they start talking to me about how they believe that I want babies to die and mm-hmm. how, you know, and then all the things that go along with that, but like these conspiracy theories about consuming blood and just totally ridiculous things. But so I think the people that believe that stuff will be really sincerely afraid that bad things are going to happen. And I hope that there's a way that we can reach them to say that those things are lies. A lot of times those have anti-Semitic roots and they have racist roots. And hopefully comfort them to say, like, actually, what we want to happen is for people to be healthier and safer and whatnot. But as far as, you know, whether your second question about whether meaningful change will happen, I think hopefully we'll be able to stem the tide of negative things that have been happening. So sort of just like in a reactive way, hopefully be able to maybe undo some executive orders, maybe put some short-term protective measures in place that just correct some really pressing immediate concerns. It's an interesting question because people who are very far on the left and who have backgrounds in community organizing and political theory and things like that, I think aren't very hopeful that electing Joe Biden will change the foundational things that are sort of at the root of why life is so hard for so many people right now, or for in America in general. Like, they don't believe that Joe Biden is going to be able to address the economic forces that, you know, cause monopolies and cause people to have no guarantee to housing or food and basic necessities. And so on that level, I don't think we can really hope for just really, really deep systemic changes, but it's absolutely still necessary to elect the people we're trying to elect because, or rather I would say, but I do think we can hope for really, really important shorter term things that, you know, we absolutely need to stop people from getting hurt. And then also I can't forget to mention all the important legislation that we need to pass to stem the climate crisis, and which I think Joe Biden will be able to steward through Congress.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your engagement with these issues and even my line of questioning. I think I personally feel like he and Kamala Harris are saying things that will get them elected. I mean this in a positive way. I think the fracking and the climate change and the what are we going to do with the Supreme Court? I feel like they're being a bit cautious about what they give away now. But my sense is, you know, when they actually get in, they'll just start doing the stuff a little bit, I hope. Because as a Canadian, I am a big fan of your most Canadian politician, Bernie Sanders. He was like my guy. He seemed very Canadian, and he seemed to have the same sort of sense of collective good that I appreciate, you know? So and I feel like his whole being and part of the process was to try to influence people like Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to shift over. And I feel like they have, and I think they will. That's what I want to say about it. So I'm hopeful. I appreciate your hope as well. I was just texting a friend today about this. I do think your country in particular has an issue where opinions have become facts. Like, it's interchangeable. Mm-hmm. It's hard to argue or have a meaningful discussion with someone when they think their opinion is the truth and the facts don't matter. Right. Have you experienced this in your daily life with your friends where you're like, no, that's not actually based on anything. That's just something you believe. Do you have these kinds of conversations? It sounds like you did with some of the people you had to cold call, but in your social group, in your community, are you seeing people like not take facts into consideration and just go with what they feel is right? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I don't really encounter that in my in my daily life with friends or family and things like that.
Okay.
But the way I do encounter it is, or the way I think about it is, there's this idea that, or a phrase I see repeated from people on the right pretty often is, facts don't care about your feelings. And they say that as sort of like a rallying cry because they believe that people on the left or protesters are totally impulsively acting on their feelings and they're crybabies and they want things that they don't deserve and stuff like that. But I think that it's pretty backwards because fundamentally, I think a couple things. One, it's like feelings are important. they have feelings too. We have feelings. The issue isn't whether or not we need to have feelings or care about each other's feelings or our own feelings, but the issue is how we respond to them and how we choose to behave based on them or not based on them or whatever. Yeah. And just this whole denial, I think they like the idea that they are stoic, totally rationally minded people. And you see this in, like, you know, like the intellectual faction of the right, like people like Jordan Peterson, who are actual professors, mm-hmm. and they're having classes about logic and having classes, online courses about how to logically prove things and prove things to other people. And to all of that, they say, one, like, logic has nothing to do with the sorts of things that we're talking about. Logic is only about whether the things that you're saying actually support the conclusion you're trying to reach. But logic, by definition, can't prove anything about the actual world around us, because you still, ultimately, the only thing that determines whether your premises are sound or not sound, or your premises are true or not true, is actually observing and judging those premises. That's got nothing to do with logic. Logic is just about the rules of how the premises all connect to each other and what they build up to. Oh, God, I'm getting a little bit off the rails.
No, it's fine. I brought it up. By the way, I feel like Bernie Sanders feels more Canadian than Jordan Peterson, if I might add. We're not a big fans here of Jordan here. Most of us, anyway. And I think you're right. There's this whole typifying thing, you know, people are a certain way and that's all they are, these broad generalizations. But I don't know, the more I consume American media, it feels like, and then they go to these undecided voters, or they go to the heart of some of these, and you're just like, it seems like, how do you have a rational discussion, a logical discussion with someone who is mostly you know, reacting with their feelings, like what you just said about how the right seems to, you know, degrade the left by saying, oh, that's all just passion, you're not thinking. I feel like it's the opposite. And I feel like a lot of what the right does and says tends to be this projection. And it's just meant to disarm us all into having a normal conversation. And it's very confusing. And it's why people take things they often take matters into their own hands. But right now, the matters are facts becoming opinions and not facts, if that makes any sense. Like, it's very confusing. And anyway, I feel like some of this, like I said moments ago, might feed into the mindset of some of the subjects in your new book. I'm trying to segue from our political discussion into this, you know, talk about your excellent new book, Mirror Sound. And I wonder if, before I go too much further, can you sort of summarize or explain what Mirror Sound is all about?
Yeah. Mirror Sound is a book. It's a kind of a large art book, photo book format book about musicians who record at home or record in their own studios. Basically, people who make records in any sort of non-traditional way, where they're a part of the process from the technical side and all the way, or from the songwriting all the way to the technical side, and kind of acting as artists and engineers at the same time.
Right. And you made the book with a couple of collaborators, correct?
Yeah, I collaborated with graphic designer Lawrence Azarod on the book, and he and I kind of developed the concept together, and a photographer, Daniel Topete, whose photos are the backbone of the book and just unbelievably beautiful, in my opinion.
Yeah, they're lovely. It's a wonderfully designed book, if I might say. Azarad stuck out for me because of my love of the author Michael Azarad. Is Lawrence related to him?
Yeah, they're cousins.
That's odd. So you got Spencer Tweedy. Some of us know your dad, Jeff, and your mom. By the way, how's your mom doing? I always like to ask, because I'm Facebook friends with your mom.
Oh, yeah.
And I know she's had some struggles with her health over the last 10, 15 years, it feels like.
Yeah.
As long as I've been on Facebook almost. How's she doing?
She's doing well. Thanks for asking. She's doing
good.
Pretty well, yeah.
Yeah, I always love her posts, and I don't know her personally. I know we have lots of mutual friends. You know how Facebook, when it started, you're just like, oh yeah, mutual friend, sure. Now I don't do it anymore, but
yeah, totally.
She's a figure that has loomed large in the. I'm a big fan of Chicago and Chicago music, and so anyway, there's like a lot of stuff. Anyway, we have lots of mutual friends, so I'm glad she's doing well. Anyway, so yeah, that's funny. You got Spencer Tweedy, Lawrence Azarad. So something going on here with the next generation of people interested in underground culture and music. That's fascinating itself. Are you friendly with Lawrence, or was it just a working relationship?
Oh, we're pretty close. I've known him for a really long time because he has designed, Lawrence Azarad has designed like 7 or 8 album packages for Wilco for my dad over the years. And in that time, we've become friends.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, so Lawrence's dad, Michael, and I have spoken many times, and Michael's been on the show. So it's all coming. And your dad's been on the show, actually. It's all coming full circle. Anyway, it's a wonderful idea for a book. And as I alluded to near the top of this conversation, I think it's timely, given how many of us are trying to do some work from our home spaces or spaces that would be considered unconventional. Some might say less than professional, which is a horrible thing to say, I think, having read your book. What exactly motivated you to want to explore this idea of sort of independent, or I should be careful here because there's a wonderful section in your book where you do a distinction between independence and interdependence, which I found fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
And I'll ask you about that in a moment in terms of music making. But first of all, yes, what exactly prompted you to explore this? And within that was the idea inspired because of the pandemic, or did all of this happen before? I'm gathering most of this happened before we found ourselves in this weird mode of mostly, you know, self-isolating. Can you speak to those two things? Was it because of what's going on right now that prompted you to think, yeah, this idea has legs, or has this been germinating for longer than that?
We finished the book totally before the pandemic started at all. So
interesting.
It's a coincidence that it feels so relevant right now, and I won't say it's a happy coincidence, although I do hope that whatever helpfulness that the book contains or inspiration or anything like that is, you know, even more important and helpful in light of the fact that we're all now largely stuck at home.
It feels very topical somehow, doesn't it?
Yeah. It was an accident. I just won't say it was a happy accident because there's nothing happy about what people are going through. But yeah. And, as far as why I was motivated to make the book, it was largely because I think that albums, I think that music that's made by one person or maybe one small group of really close collaborators working in their own space or working self-engineering and using tools that they love and sort of being involved in every aspect of the process tends to have a unique sound. And I think it has some cohesive just gel in it that makes it really special to me. And so I was thinking about records made that way, like records made by Emmett Rhodes and more recently by Kevin Parker and Tame Impala and just tons and tons of artists who work this way, and how it's kind of a thread that connects them. I think there's something, I'm a drummer, primarily a drummer, so I always think about it in terms of a rhythm section, and it's really, really special when a drummer and a bass player in a rhythm section have a good relationship and they kind of, you know, they just sound great together and can anticipate each other's moves and just respect each other. I think you can hear those good relationships. And then when
chemistry.
The rhythm...
We call it chemistry, I guess, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, chemistry for short. And those relationships are really special, but then a simple way to put it, why I was motivated to make Mirror Sound is that chemistry is off the charts when the person playing the drums on the track and the person playing the bass is literally the same person, multi-tracking, overdubbing their own, multiple instruments on top of each other. It just allows for things that, or allows for compositions that are intricate because, you know, the same mind is producing every little aspect of it, and or at least in many cases that's the case, and I really love that, and I think it produces special music.
I share many of your sentiments there. I too am primarily someone who plays the drums. That's the role I've played in most of the bands I've been in, and in isolation I've been trying to learn how to play guitar more. But yeah, your book had me, and I moved recently to a house where I can actually have my drum kit set up, and that hasn't happened in like 20 years. Yeah, so it's set up, and I read your book, and I was like, there's a fella here in Canada, he goes by the name Daniel Romano. I don't know if you know Daniel Romano, but he's a great
and prolific musical artist. He's released 10 albums this year.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, he's fantastic. I'm a big fan. And I asked him, like, he's got a project where it's called Ancient Shapes, and it's like his like kind of more of a punk thing. And he begins every Ancient Shapes record by playing the drums. And he says he has idea. He just plays beats and records them in his home studio. And then after, he layers the lyrics and all the instrumentation on after. And I found that puzzling. Have you done something like that? Have you, as the drummer, do you play other instruments?
Yeah, I play some guitar and just enough keyboard to get ideas across alone if there's nobody waiting for me to figure it out.
It's interesting because you talk about the singular chemistry of someone making something by themselves in isolation. You come from like a bloodline where you play with your brother Sam, right?
Uh-huh.
And then you play with your dad Jeff and then your mom Sue. Sometimes she joins in too, right?
She's pretty stage shy, and she does play guitar, but she doesn't allow us to enjoy that very often.
Okay. My point, though, is that you've got the family band, that's a whole other kind of chemistry where people harmonize, and it's like the same voice. It's beautiful, and that's something else. Like, that is chemistry. Then you talk about people recording everything by themselves, like yourself, like I mentioned, Dan. Like, I'm thinking, I read your book, and then your dad has a book out right now called How to Write One Song. So there's I've been so motivated by the Tweety family to actually down and try to make some songs that now I'm like, do I have to? I have a little mixer that I take with me to record interviews, and it's got 6 inputs in it.
Nice.
And but I have 6 mics. I don't have enough stands, but I was reading your book, and I'm like, I'm going to go buy some stands so I can properly mic my drum kit and just try to make a bunch of beats. Is that part of the motivation for this book, is to get people like me, delusional idiots, to think that we can do everything that you can do?
Yeah, I mean, if it's fun and if you want to do that, which it sounds like it is, I think it's really... That's really exciting to me that it could help inspire someone or break out of some fears of some creative blocks.
Yeah, and so I ask these questions because there are moments in your prose where things get a little technical, but I feel like you've made it as accessible as possible. Like, it's a little, some of it, would you agree, some of it's a little inside. You're talking about compressors and all these different kinds of gadgets and things, but the rest of it is kind of just talking to people about how they do stuff. You need kind of a balance of that, right? Like, this is not, on some level, this requires a certain amount of expertise to pull off, right?
I don't really think so. I mean, I tried to... The goal is to make it as accessible as possible. There are a couple of technical terms like compressors and equalizers are just names of general categories of equipment. But the idea is hopefully that there's enough of a basic description of those things included to be able to know roughly what artists are talking about. And generally, it stays away from that stuff because it focuses on all of the more on the creative side and more on like a... To go back to feelings, like around like the emotional life of artists and how they decide to make what they make.
Yeah, well, I had brought up your family connection there, and I was going somewhere with that actually, because the distinction between playing with people that you have a chemical reaction with and doing everything yourself. Like, I think you were trying to say that someone who plays the bass and the drums on the same track is going to be intimately connected with those parts. And that's true. That's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. But what is what you're talking about and some of the examples in this book of people just, and, you know, I mentioned Dan Romano earlier, people who just do everything themselves, what does that say about maybe the social aspect of music? Because to me, I don't know about you, but like, I've loved bands my whole life. Like, the notion of a band, a gang of people getting together, and then as time goes on, due to circumstances maybe within or outside of their control, someone leaves the band and someone else is brought in, and maybe they do a reunion tour with that person or something. And I don't know what this says about me. I have some issues with things changing. I'll tell you that right now. I admit it. But there's something about that band chemistry that's lost, isn't it? So I think, like, I see the band and they've got a new drummer or a new bass player or whatever it is. I'm like, do you have that? Do you clamor for the original version of the group sometimes? Do you ever think that?
Well, not necessarily for the original version, but I totally get what you're saying about loving the chemistry of a group and loving the special things that happen when multiple people play music together and with people who like each other play music together, or if they don't like each other, at least they kind of see they can connect and they have some sort of, like, they're communicating musically. That's like one of the most special things in the world, and I think it produces great music. So the idea behind Mirror Sound and the idea of musicians who produce records alone or sort of alone isn't that it's better than bands or better than music that's made in a group, but rather just that it can be a really cool way to work. It does tend to produce this stuff that I think has its own unique thing going on. But also a lot of the artists in the book play in groups too, or part of their self-engineering is with a band or with friends that they invite over one at a time to overdub different parts on the recording and things like that. So there's a wide range of collaboration versus totally solitary creativity. And it's, I think that it's nice when people are able to have both in their life. They both just bring different things to the recording, and they're satisfying in different ways.
Yeah, I think the other part of the social thing is that I assume, like, I was listening to some Emmett Rhodes records because of your book, and totally magical records that this, he's passed away, I believe, but he did everything himself, right? And I think all I can, like, vocal harmonies and layers of sounds and all these things. And all I can think of is, like, that seems like a lot of work. Like, I haven't gone and gotten the mic stands yet because I'm like, oh, so I'm going to have to do everything myself and make it up. And so there's part of me, and I'm busy. So it's a weird lark. I have written and recorded songs in my past for sure. But the idea of now switching gears and going down and doing that every once in a while, it's a lot of work, isn't it, to do everything yourself? Would you say, have you done this yourself? Have you built a song up completely with all the layers and all the stuff all on your own?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. and it is a lot of work. But when it's going, when the process gets going and things are, you know, feeling, the music is feeling good and your ideas are kind of exciting and you're, like, entertaining yourself, it feels like the time passes really quickly and all of the difficult or kind of menial things of setting up stands or moving a microphone and whatever all feels worth it. It's like the pain gets forgotten and the rewards get remembered. But it is hard. And Emmett Rhodes himself actually.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mentioned in the interview I did with him that he was really at some point just didn't want to press the button anymore, like he was tired, and that's totally understandable because sometimes the menial tasks do feel like a slog.
Yeah, there are a couple of subjects in your book that talk about, you know, how resourceful they've had to become to figure this out on their own. Some also say that they've chose to do things on their own because of negative experiences that they had in actual, you know, studios working with external engineers. How much of what Mirror Sound is all about has to do with sort of just control? Not to plug the name of this show, but creative control, in fact.
Yeah.
The notion of actually, like, I can do this. Like, I don't need someone second-guessing my vision of this. How much of a factor does that seem to play throughout the interviews you've done with these people, the stories you've heard? Is control a major factor here?
It definitely is. And that question that you're raising was one of the biggest questions that I struggled with while we were making the book, because on one hand, it started to feel like there's a lot of negativity associated with control, because colloquially control is associated with like being a control freak, or like not being able to tolerate the input of others or having sort of an authoritarian personality. So at some point I was trying to think through, like, you know, as a self-recording musician, is it really just that we're like not very tolerant or open to other people's ideas? And so do we work in solitude because it's sort of like an antisocial behavior?
Yeah.
And I thought about it, like that to me is a really serious concern, because, it closes yourself off, and it also, I think, closes the world off to a lot of it's important to be open to other people's ideas. And so I wanted to think about that, and I think it's kind of just the fact that control enters the picture is, I think it's just sort of an imprecision of language, because it seems like what artists, musicians talk about building their own recording space or buying their own tools so that they can have control, but it seems like it's actually about freedom. It's actually about empowering themselves to be able to do what they want to do apart from other structures or other people who had too much control in the first place. So it's not necessarily about like being a totalitarian, like I get to do everything my way, and more so about just having the freedom to do stuff that's satisfying to them and to feel empowered and all of those positive things. Although that said, as someone who self-records too, that is a really satisfying part of it. Sometimes you just want to be able to do your creative project and not have to navigate any of the social aspects that come with collaborating with other people. I think that's totally okay. You know, that doesn't make people, that doesn't make anybody bad or antisocial. It just means that sometimes you want your own corner too. So that's where I think control enters the picture.
Well, I wonder if this, you know, we kind of talked about, or I did anyway, talked about how this book has some instructive components, and I feel like it could be just as instructive for engineers, for producers, mm-hmm. you know, to hear these sort of testimonials about what people, because you very rarely can say to it, unless you have a big fight, you very rarely can say to an engineer or a producer you're working with, like, I don't appreciate this. Like, you know, the distinction you're making between control and freedom is interesting, but within all that, there's constructive criticism, or there's just a good tip that, you know, maybe you don't want to, that's probably not going to work out. And someone might be like, you're infringing upon my vision here. And on some level they might be, on another might be right. It's confusing. Like, there's an interesting quote here in your book from, I believe it's from Greta Kiln. Am I pronouncing Greta's name correctly, from Frankie Cosmos?
Greta Klein.
Oh, I'm sorry. Klein. There you go. I have clay on the mind. I need my children. They like making things. I'm sorry. Greta Klein. Yes, from Frankie Cosmos, says, the first couple times that I've ever made records with collaborators, I was really freaked out to let go of my little insular process. I didn't like sharing. And that's a bit out of context, but there is this weird thing where you've made something and have an idea of what it's going to be like at the end, but you got to rely on all these other people to bring it to fruition, and you can't help but feel like these people are people, and they're going to help me, but they're also kind of obstacles. Right. They're sort of obstacles in the way of me getting to where I want to go. And so I just bring this up because, like I said, I feel like this is a topical book, we are getting a little inward. I don't know about you. Like, I rarely, I go get groceries. My kids and I, my wife and I, were all in the house all the time. You know, they're doing virtual school. Yeah. I can feel it. Sorry, I'm not trying to have a panic attack on the during the interview with you. But it's just like an insular time, and we're getting really inward. And social constructs and social communication is frayed. And so part of that, and I'm not saying that's a negative. It's a negative part of your book, but it is fascinating how many musicians I've talked to that said, to be honest, pandemic lockdown, I was already there. I sit in my house and I make my records. I go out when I go on tour when I have to, and I go get stuff when I have to. But honestly, I'm kind of a hermit. I'm writing songs. I'm recording them in my house. It's been very commonplace. So I guess I'm wondering if all of this self-recording has been prescient. Has it prepared everyone for the world in the next couple of years? Like, it kind of feels that way. I don't want to suggest you're some sort of wizard or sorcerer, but do you feel like maybe those of you who self-record, you were kind of onto something given what we're all going through right now, don't you think?
Maybe. definitely not going to claim any wizard abilities, but yeah, I think we're... I think what you're saying makes sense, and I can speak from my family's perspective. You were mentioning your friends who are musicians and who already kind of had the same, for whom the pandemic hasn't really changed their lifestyle, and that's definitely been the case for my family mostly, because when my dad isn't on tour, his routine is to be at home, write songs, and be at the studio recording songs. And to an extent, that's been my life for the past several years too.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think some musicians and some artists who have been lucky to live that crazy, or that pretty special creative lifestyle have maybe gotten a head start on navigating all this time spent at home. But I think the important thing throughout all of it, like you were mentioning, feeling maybe I'm reading into it wrong, but it sounded like you were mentioning feeling maybe a little bit stifled by constantly being at home and not being able to escape family.
Let me interject and say, I don't want to paint a negative photo, a picture of this, or a photo. Suddenly I'm a photographer.
Yeah.
Let me just say that I, too, have thought in the last few months, like right now it's been a bit weird. The winter is coming, and it's going to get more and more unlikely that you'll feel like going for an outdoor walk or going to the park and all that stuff, which we've been able to do. By and large, this has been revelatory on a professional level for me, because I don't have to commute to my, you know, the place, my work. I don't have to go to the office. You know, everything's at my fingertips. Like, I'm not bothered by people. Does that come across misanthropic or something? Like, I like people. I believe in people.
No.
I like being not on the bus and the subway and in traffic. I like to just get up and start. It's so efficient. So there's part, like, I get up, you know, feed the family, the food. They're not livestock. I make food. I make actual food for my family and for breakfast. And then I carry on with my day. And it's right here. I could be in my pajamas. Yeah. You can't see me. I'm not in my pajamas, but I could be. That's great. And so I feel like everything, like some of these people in your book feel like a little bit like they've been kind of misled. Mm-hmm. Lied to, like it's like a revelation. Mm-hmm. Oh, I can do this myself. I don't have to spend $600 a day at your studio. I can just get up, and when the inspiration strikes, like your dad says it all the time, when I have inspiration, I have my phone. I can record on my voice memos. I can go. I have my own studio. It's great. So I feel like it's. I just want to be clear. I don't dislike it. It's sad, and I feel badly for anyone who's lost someone or is sick. But this has been. Mm-hmm. Totally a revolution. It's like all the shit they told us we had to do. I had to, you know, commute and take a laptop from my house to their office. Don't have to do it anymore. And isn't that good? Like, I feel like part of the book, the strength of the book and the timing thing is, this is how a lot of us are feeling, like this sense of discovery. Oh, I can be kind of self-sufficient. And that's what I just want to be clear. I love my family. It's a little challenging. My kids are young. You're like an adult. My son is 9 and my daughter is 5, so it's sad. So they're a little lonely, and they, you know, it's different. But I'm just gonna, I just wanted to interject. It's been a long interjection and say I'm relatively okay with how everything's going, and I relate to these sort of self-sufficient models that are, you know, part of your book. I think it's great, if I may say.
So, yeah.
Okay. No, totally. Does that help? Okay. Okay. Good.
Oh yeah. No. Absolutely. I also remind myself that ultimately all of the commuting and the lots of people around us all the time and even like office life are not the way everybody lives. And
yeah, that's true. I don't take it for granted either. Yeah.
Oh that's yeah. No, I don't mean to say that as if I'm pointing out something that you missed or anything.
you alluded to your own privilege, and I feel privileged that I have a job and a workplace that you know currently that enables me and has said, yeah, no, there's no point in all of us congregating and my wife in the same. Yeah. We're lucky. I feel very lucky, and I'm trying to appreciate this, but I do think a book like yours is going to be revelatory for musicians. And like I said, mm-hmm. I think it could be revelatory for engineers and producers who think or wonder, well, why don't people come back to our studio? Was I a jerk to them? Was I, you know, did I say something that stifled them instead of inspiring them to create in the moment? Like, just a lot of the heavy hands that have been on some of us are kind of having to lift out of circumstance. And I think that's freeing us, liberating us to think a bit differently about how we work, where we work.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a big part of your book.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think that's a cool way of putting it. And it's funny that that little picture you just painted about an engineer in a traditional studio asking themselves, what's going on? Why don't artists want to work with me or something? And reflecting on whether they've been kind enough, because I don't think that there's like an epidemic of unkind engineers in traditional studios. And I also don't think that the things that self-recording artists, the musicians in the book, the things that motivated them to start working on their own or to start controlling the, you know, their own tools and how they make records. I don't think that those things are even unique to our industry. I think there's a section that talks about this in the book a little bit. It's not as if the traditional structures of making records and releasing records are like uniquely full of rude people or bigoted people or over controlling people. It's just about these like general things I happen to be focusing on how they relate to music because that's the medium that is that's the industry that I love and that I wanted to explore. But
it's there. I mean, it is there, though. Would you agree? I mean, any of us who have toured with anyone who is a non-white male and encountered a different engineer in a different city has had a weird experience.
Definitely.
I guess I never really saw myself as a person of color so much until... Sorry, I always say this, and it's true. I never really am aware of my difference until some lunkhead points it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you talk to women or anyone else who does not identify as a straight white male, you start to hear the stories.
Right.
And I've experienced them. I've witnessed them. I've witnessed engineers be rude and dismissive of people that they assume don't know what they're talking about because there is also, I think, and I don't want to paint a general brush, there's lots of beautiful, sweet, kind producers and engineers, but some of them are, let's just say it, embittered failed musicians.
Yeah.
And so, and a lot of the resentment they have towards their lot in life comes out and kind of projecting it against the person who has made something really magical happen for themselves. And I feel like there's some of that swimming around in there too. And I know like Yuka Honda from Chibo Matto and a few others in your book, I think, talk about, you know, being in studios and having to recognize that in people, that they are, on some level, they're there to help you. On another, they're there to challenge you. And in some cases, they seem there to sort of stifle your impulses. And that's strange. And so, I think that's swimming around in the subtext of your book as well.
Yeah, definitely. And Yeah, I've seen that too. When I play shows with my girlfriend's band that she leads, it's her band and she's the songwriter. We walk in the door at a venue and, I mean, this won't even be a surprising story to other musicians listening or probably lots of other people, but we walk in the door and she's usually invisible and they talk to me or any of the other members of the band to call the shots. And then it's as if like, you know, oh my God, you're in charge. How's that possible? But, like on a positive note, I want to say that there's something extremely, extremely beautiful about traditional studios to me because, you know, at its best, it's a traditional studio is a place where engineers with whom a musician has a good relationship can have a dedicated space to collaborate, and it's a dedicated separate space where lots of other people can be a part of it. And I think that's an important part of society. I'm glad we're at a place where recording studios exist. I don't want them to go away. It's just that they always need to be built around respectful relationships and reasons that people want to be there. Also, engineers are creative people too. That's kind of the point of the book, is that when musicians decide to take control of the technical aspects of producing music, they're becoming engineers. They are engineers, and engineering is ultimately a creative act. So I think like engineers that primarily work in traditional studios or whose main creative work is producing other people are creative people too. And yeah, I don't know where I was going with that, but it's just, I love the idea of having dedicated spaces for it too.
Those spaces are so magical in their own right. They're so full of history, and obviously they have been calibrated to sound about the best they can. Like, I've been in spaces like that and you're just like, wow, like to be in Electrical Audio in Chicago and be like, wow,
yeah,
so much amazing stuff has happened in this room. And And I've been in studios like that in Toronto where I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to make a record in this place that so-and-so made a record. And they end up kind of, it's all psychological, but they kind of haunt you in a nice way, hopefully. And so I think that's inspirational as well. And I think, I think there's lots to chew on in your book in terms of all of these sort of issues, and the stories are great. I did want to ask, since we're talking about inspiration, I alluded to this earlier. This is interesting to me that you have a book out called Mirror Sound. And I said this, your dad has a book called How to Write One Song. And they're both, as I said, I think they're interesting stories, but they're very instructive. Do you have a sense of where that impulse comes from, maybe both of you, to not only create things and try to invent ways of creating things, but to also take the time to impart what you've learned to others? Like, I think that's a really nice, unselfish thing that both of you have done. I think it's probably a coincidence that these books are out at the same time. But I do think that like I said, both, having read both, I'm fired up to write horrible songs on my own. They're going to be bad. I'm just telling you, I'll do my best. I like good stuff, but when I go down there, I can't do it. I'm going to try. But all of that, I think a lot of people, if they process these things, are going to be like, yes, I will say your dad has stuff where he talks about, hey, have you read your dad's new book?
Yes, I've read it a few times. Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know why that amused me. I assume you had, but anyway.
No.
He has these. Yeah. It'd be funny if you're like, totally. No, I get enough out of that guy. Why do I need to read his book? Anyway, he's got these like word games and, verb noun games. And I've been playing them. You know what I mean? I don't mean to say I'm playing them, but I've been doing them. Super fun.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
Super fun. And like I say, I read your book and I'm already like, oh, I'm scrolling. Like, how do I get used microphone stands so I can mic my drum kit? Like, I'm doing it. Your books have got me working. And my question was, do you have a sense, this shared impulse you and your father at least have to not only do things, but to teach people or to help people, inspire people? Mm. Do you know where that comes from?
Not really, but I think it's a byproduct of having lots of different interests. And speaking for myself, I love to write, and I've been writing since I was a preteen. Like, had a blog very early on in my life, and honestly pretty early on in terms of the blogging boom, I guess. It was sort of like second generation already, but like around 2006, 2007, 2008, it was still, I don't know why I'm bragging about my blogging original cred, but anyway,
it's a
weird
flex in 2020, if I might say, but still, that's good. No, you should be proud.
Yeah, I am. I am in a weird way. But I think mostly what it has, it's not my dad writing a book and me writing this book have less to do with altruistic desires to help and more to do with just having, at least for myself, having a lot of different interests. And I've noticed that when I love something like recording music, I kind of impulsively start looking for ways to incorporate that into other media, like, or other creative pursuits like writing, just because it's fun to kind of tie them all together and to like it's kind of like you can bring one interest into a lot of different areas or express it in a lot of different ways. And I think for my dad, it's pretty similar. But the fact that the two books end up sort of interlocking with each other, because How to Write One Song doesn't totally talk about making records and the recording aspect of making music, and Mirror Sound doesn't talk very much about songwriting, is a really cool thing to me. I love that they accidentally fit together in that way.
Yeah.
I would say that How to Write One Song is the more revolutionary of the two. I think that How to Write One Song is the one that you can do with nothing but a pencil, or even nothing but your mind in sitting in a room. And that's pretty cool to me. Mirror Sound ultimately does depend on some a little bit more material stuff, but I think they both, the fact that you're saying that it's inspired you to make quote unquote awful songs, I think is a very, that's really gratifying. That makes me happy, and other people will be the judge of that if you choose to share.
No,
them.
I think they'll be okay. I think they'll be all right. I'll work on them, but no, I know you're downplaying the altruistic aspect, but I will say, for what it's worth, I have some gratitude towards you. And you know, if your dad was here, I'd tell him the same thing. I have gratitude towards this because I think it's very important. When you get to a point where you've accrued knowledge and skills to pass it on, to let other people know that they have an entry point, because so much of what I read in your book is about people feeling closed off from certain processes, and this opening themselves, forcing themselves really to get into it and get into the muck of it, and then coming out the other side feeling like, yeah, I can do this. Yeah. Like, it's very empowering. So yes, both books I think are really empowering, and if for what it's worth, Spencer, I think you should be proud. I think you should be proud of this book.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I just wanted to comment on what you said very quickly, which is that for me, it's kind of like capturing inspiration, because when something feels really exciting to me, or when you stumble upon some way of doing things creatively and it feels like it opens up a bunch of doors, at least in myself, and I suspect that other people feel this too, I feel like, what can I do to write down how I got here? How can I lay the breadcrumbs to remember how to get myself back here? And part of that is like a fear of not being able to get back there. It's like, I want to bottle this, and I want to be able to access it whenever I want. Basically, it's an anxiety, but it's also like an excitement to, it's like, ooh, this feels cool. This is an exciting discovery. I want to document it. And yeah, anyway, just wanted to interject that.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that distinction as well. Well, the book is called Mirror Sound, A Look into the People and Processes Behind Self-Recorded Music. It's out now via Prestel, I believe. Yes, Prestel. Is that the place?
Yeah, Prestel.
Prestel. Okay, there you go. I see I'm mispronouncing things today. I don't know what's wrong with me. I apologize. Yes, Prestel. And is there, if people want to learn more about this book and you, where would you want to send them exactly?
They could go to mirrorsoundbook.com, or they could go to spencertweedy.com, and they could find all the info there.
Okay, rad. Now, normally I go out on a song by my guests if they're musicians, and you are a musician, Spencer. Let's not beat around the bush. You make songs. is there something that you've contributed to or something you've made recently that we can share with the people right now?
Yeah, I would love to share really any song off of our new album, Love is the King, that my dad put out this month. But if we were picking a specific song, maybe Gwendolyn would be a good choice, or really, I would be excited to share any of them from that
album.
Okay,
Gwendolyn's a lovely song. It was one of the singles, as I recall. What do you want to tell us about that song? Does anything about the conception or creation or capturing of that song perhaps relate to anything we've been talking about or anything to do with any of the practices illustrated in your book by chance?
A little bit, because like you mentioned, my dad records song ideas on voice memos on his phone. And the way that he works to make the final recordings for songs is ultimately pretty self-controlled. We work with an engineer, a dedicated engineer, Tom Schick. So my dad isn't necessarily directly twisting the knobs and pushing buttons on recording equipment, but I think a lot of the same ideas are at play at the loft, the Wilco loft, where my dad records. Going back to why he started setting up the Wilco loft, why he and other members in Wilco started making the loft, which was they're getting, you know, advances from record labels to make records, and they thought, well, why don't we, instead of booking time in a traditional studio, why don't we start putting some recording equipment in our warehouse space and see if we can, you know, do this ourselves? Yeah. And it has just kind of stuck, and he still works that way.
Right.
So yeah, it's related. I would say it's related in that way.
Well, I love the song Gwendolyn, and I'm not trying to downplay it in any way, but I just want to take a second to congratulate you or commend you on the drum beat for the song Natural Disaster. Is that okay? Can I do that?
Oh, thank you.
It's a good one.
Yeah, I'll accept it.
It's a good one. I like it. It's a subtle kind of shuffle thing, and I don't want to do... People should check out Natural Disaster as well, but we're going to go out on Gwendolyn because that was Spencer's choice. And I like to honor my guest choices. So this is Gwendolyn by Jeff Tweedy and his sons, Spencer and Sam. Spencer, this was a real pleasure to get to speak with you about Mirror Sound, and I hope you enjoyed it. And thanks for this, and best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, too.
I start missing home. holds my hand between the knees. It's like a dream.
That was fun. Nice to have Spencer Tweedy on this, the 586th episode of Creative Control. Thank you, Spencer. Thank you for being on Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and available wherever it is that you get your podcasts. So I don't know how you're listening to this right now. Presumably you're using the thing you like to use. But if you're not using the thing you like to use, you're using this something kind of begrudgingly, like, oh, I wish I could be using the thing I actually like to use. It's the show is probably there. It's on Apple and Google and Spotify and all sorts of things. So whatever it is you use, search for Creative Control and it will be there. If you can't, for some reason, find an episode of the show that you've heard about. You heard me reference the fact that Spencer's dad, Jeff Tweedy, was on the show. Well, I don't know how far, you know, far back that goes, but sometimes there's like caps, feed caps, you know, that they only have like 100 episodes of a show, even though there's like, in my case, there's almost 600 episodes. Anyway, if you're looking for an episode and it's not in your favorite thing, or if you want to sign up for my monthly newsletter, all of that stuff is at my website. You can learn how to do all of those things at vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative. You can also follow me on Twitter or Instagram at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast, to keep it going. $6 or more gets you access to exclusive audio content, so please consider going to patreon.com/creativecontrol and making a flexible monthly donation today. Oh, you can also make annual donations now. They don't want me to tell you that, but that's a new thing. So if you want, you can... Someone just did that. They donated like $40. That's great. That's nice. It's very nice. So you can do that too. I just wanted to correct myself. Anyway, thanks again to who can I thank here? Oh, in-kind support. Why don't I thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. Also, my friend Jim Guthrie, wonderful musician. Actually, in the spirit of home recording, he was a home recording guru when we all lived in Guelph before he moved to Toronto, and now he has a little home studio himself in Toronto. Jim is, like I say, he was one of the first people I encountered, many people encountered, who figured out how to record things at home, and he's a great guy, and you can learn more about him and his music, mostly all homemade, at jimguthrie.org. Also, thank you for listening to this episode with Spencer. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you enjoyed what you heard today, I hope you'll check out other episodes of the show. Maybe follow the podcast or subscribe to it or something, or tell your friends about it. That's always a nice thing. Or just carry on with your day. You don't have to do anything I just said. It's really up to you. It's a free country, depending on where you live. Hopefully, it's a free country. Okay, I'm going to go. I feel like I'm... saying things I shouldn't. I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.